Our Country, the Marvel of Nations. Chapter 2, The Progress of a Century. Have the foregoing predictions been justified, and the expectations of these great men been fulfilled? Every person whose reading is ordinarily extensive has something of an idea of what the United States is today. He likewise has an idea, so far as words can convey it to his mind, of what this country was at the commencement of its history. The only object, then, in presenting statistics and testimony on this point is to show that our rapid growth has struck mankind with the wonder of a constant miracle. Said Émile de Girardin in La Liberté, 1868, "The population of America, not thinned by any conscription, multiplies with prodigious rapidity, and the day may before long be seen when they will number 60 or 80 millions, 76 and one quarter millions in 1901, of souls." This parvenu, one recently risen to notice, is aware of his importance and destiny. Hear him proudly exclaim, "America for Americans!" See him promising his alliance to Russia, and we see that power, which well knows what force is, grasp the hand of this giant of yesterday. In view of his unparalleled progress and combination, what are the little toys with which we vex ourselves in Europe? What is this needle gun we are anxious to get from Prussia that we may beat her next year with it? Had we not better take from America the principle of liberty she embodies, out of which have come her citizen pride, her gigantic industry, and her formidable loyalty to the destinies of her republican land? The Dublin, Ireland nation, as long ago as the year 1850, said, "In the east there is arising a colossal centaur called the Russian Empire. With a civilized head and front, it has the sinews of a huge barbaric body. There, one man's brain moves 70 million, now 136 million, World Almanac. There, all the traditions of the people are of aggression and conquest in the West. There but two ranks are distinguishable, serfs and soldiers. There, the map of the future includes Constantinople and Vienna as outposts of St. Petersburg." In the West, an opposing and still more wonderful American empire is emerging. We islanders have no conception of the extraordinary events which, amid the silence of the earth, are daily adding to the power and pride of this gigantic nation. Within 3 years, territories more extensive than these three kingdoms, Great Britain, Ireland, and Scotland, France, and Italy put together, have been quietly and in almost matter-of-course fashion annexed to the Union. Within 70 years, 17 new sovereignties, the smallest of them larger than Great Britain, have peaceably united themselves to the Federation. No standing army was raised, no national debt was sunk, no great exertion was made, but there they are. And the last mail brings news of three more great states about to be joined to the 30, Minnesota in the northwest, Deseret in the southwest, and California on the shores of the Pacific. These three states will cover an area equal to one half of the European continent. Mitchell, in his School Geography, 4th Revised Edition, page 101, speaking of the United States, says, "It presents the most striking instance of national growth to be found in the history of mankind." Let us reduce these general statements to the more tangible form of facts and figures. A short time before the Great Reformation, in the days of Martin Luther, a little over 400 years ago, this Western Hemisphere was discovered. The Reformation awoke the nations, fast fettered in the galling bonds of superstition, to the fact that it is the heaven-born right of every man to worship God according to the dictates of his own conscience. But rulers are loath to lose their power, and religious intolerance still oppressed the people. Under these circumstances, a body of religious heroes at length determined to seek in the wilds of America that measure of civil and religious freedom which they so much desired. December 27, 1620, the Mayflower landed 100 of these voluntary exiles on the coast of New England. "Here," says Martin, "New England was born, and this was its first baby cry, a prayer and a thanksgiving to the Lord. Another permanent English settlement was made at Jamestown, Virginia, 13 years before this, in 1607. In process of time, other settlements were made and colonies organized, which were all subject to the English crown till the Declaration of Independence, July 4, 1776. The population of these colonies, according to the United States Magazine, amounted in 1701 to 262,000, in 1749 to 1,046,000, in 1775 to 2,803,000. Then commenced the struggle of the American colonies against the oppression of the mother country. In 1776, they declared themselves, as in justice and right they were entitled to be, a free and independent nation. In 1777, delegates from the 13 original states, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Delaware, Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia, in Congress assembled, adopted Articles of Confederation. In 1783, the War of the Revolution closed with a treaty of peace with Great Britain, whereby our independence was acknowledged and territory ceded to the extent of 815,615 square miles. In 1787, the Constitution was framed and ratified by the foregoing 13 states, and on the first day of March, 1789, it went into operation. Then the American ship of state was fairly launched, with less than 1 million square miles of territory and about 3 million souls. Such was the situation when our nation took its position of independence as one of the self-governing powers of the world. Our territorial growth since that time has been as follows. Louisiana, acquired from France in 1803, comprising 930,928 square miles of territory. Florida, from Spain in 1819, with 59,268 square miles. Texas, admitted into the Union in 1845, with 237,504 square miles. Oregon, as settled by treaty in 1846, with 380,425 square miles. California, as conquered from Mexico in 1847, with 649,762 square miles. Arizona, New Mexico, as acquired from Mexico by treaty in 1854, with 27,500 square miles. Alaska, as acquired by purchase from Russia in 1867, with 577,390 square miles. This gives a grand total of 3,678,392, 3,678,392 square miles of territory. And if we add the 80,492 miles secured by the Spanish War, we have a total of 3,758,884 square miles, which is about 4/9 of all North America, and more than 1/15 of the whole land surface of the globe. And while the United States has been thus rapidly growing, how has it been with the other leading nations of the globe? Macmillan and Company, the London publishers, in their Statesman's Yearbook for 1867, make an interesting statement of the changes that took place in Europe during the half-century between the years 1817 and 1867. They say, "The half-century has extinguished three kingdoms, one grand duchy, eight duchies, four principalities, one electorate, and four republics. Three new kingdoms have arisen, and one kingdom has been transformed into an empire. There are now 41 states in Europe against 59 which existed in 1817. Not less remarkable is the territorial extension of the superior states in the world. Russia has annexed 567,364 square miles. The United States, 1,968,009. France, 4,620. Prussia, 29,781. Sardinia, expanding into Italy, has increased by 83,041. The Indian Empire has been augmented by 431,616. The principal states that have lost territory are Turkey, Mexico, Austria, Denmark, and the Netherlands. We ask the especial attention of the reader to these particulars. During the half-century named, 21 governments disappeared altogether, and only 3 new ones arose. 5 lost in territory instead of gaining. Only 5, besides our own, added to their domain. And the one which did the most in this direction added only a little over 500,000 square miles, while we added nearly 2 million of square miles. Thus, the United States government added over 1,400,000 square miles of territory, more than any other single nation, and over 800,000 more than were added during that time by all the other nations of the earth put together. In point of population, our increase in 1798, according to the census of the several decades, has been as follows. In 1800, the total number of inhabitants in the United States was 5,305,925. In 1810, 7,239,814. In 1820, 9,638,191. In 1830, 12,866,020. In 1840, 17,069,453. In 1850, 23,191,876. In 1860, 31,445,089. In 1870, 38,555,983. In 1880, 50 million. In 1901, 76,384,461. And with what has been acquired in recently added colonies, 87 million. These figures are almost too large for the mind to grasp readily. Perhaps a better idea of the rapidity of the increase of population may be gained by looking at a few representative cities. Boston, in 1792, had 18,000 inhabitants. The census of 1900 shows 560,892. New York, in 1792, 30,000. Now about 3,437,202. Chicago, 60 years ago, was a little trading post with a few huts. Yet it contained, at the time of the Great Conflagration, in October 1871, nearly 350,000 souls. And now the census gives the number as 1,698,575. San Francisco, 60 years ago, was a barren waste, but today contains 342,782 inhabitants. The industrial growth of the country has been no less remarkable. In 1792, the United States had no cotton mills. In 1890, there were 225,759 looms, employing 174,652 hands. In 1900, the total wool clip in the United States was 288,636,621 pounds, with 17,938,000 spindles in operation. In railroads, the first timid experiment was a tramway in Quincy, Massachusetts, built in 1826. Its only purpose was the easier conveyance of building stone from the granite quarries of Quincy to Tidewater. Horses were used as the motive power. It was the germ, however, of a mighty movement in this country. The first railway in America for passengers and traffic, the Baltimore and Ohio, was chartered by the Maryland legislature in March 1827. The capital stock was at first only $500,000, and a portion of that was subscribed by the state and the city of Baltimore. Horses were its motive power, even after 65 miles of the road were built. but in 1829, Peter Cooper of New York built a locomotive in Baltimore which weighed 1 ton and made 18 miles an hour on a trial trip to Ellicott's Mills. In 1830, there were 23 miles of railway in the United States, which was increased the next year to 95. In 1835, to 1,098. In 1840, to nearly 3,000. Bryant's History of the United States, Volume 4, page 314. In 1900, 250,362, 80 miles of track had been laid. In 1899, the number of passengers carried was 523,176,508. The gross earnings in 1901 were $1.5 billion. The number of employees was 928,924. Telegraph. It was not till as late as 1840 that the magnetic telegraph was invented. Now there are 933,153 miles of wire in operation. The telephone dates from 1875, yet there are now, 1901, 1,016,777 miles of wire in the United States devoted to that purpose. In 1833, the first reaping and mowing machine was constructed, and in 1847, the first sewing machine was completed. Hundreds of thousands of both these classes of machines are now in use, and all these improvements are being multiplied by leaps and strides in geometrical progression. New machines and greater facilities for making them, larger plants for the manufacture of all classes of merchandise, and for handling and distributing the product are busying the brains of men as never before. More gigantic engineering feats of spanning ravines, tunneling mountains, bridging bays and rivers, and canaling continents than ever before attempted are now being subjected to the plans of master mechanics, while more lines and miles of telegraph and telephone wires and miles of railroad track and steamboat routes are projected or in process of construction than ever before came within the boundaries of men's wildest dreams. We have said nothing as yet of the electric light, the phonograph, the microphone, the megaphone, long-distance telephones, telepathy, long-distance photographs, etc., which are flaunting their marvelous achievements before the dazzled eyes and bewildered brains of mankind. Ocean telephone. And now comes a discovery which would seem to reach the very extreme of practicability and possibility: the power of communicating by word of mouth, not only across continents, but even under the ocean to other lands. Think of sitting down and speaking into a tube in America, and having your voice heard and understood in England, France, Germany, or any of the great countries of Europe. But such a dream will soon be realized, according to the most recent announcement, through an American invention, by the professor of mathematics of Columbia College. It is an invention by which the Atlantic and all submarine cables can be made so sensitive and powerful that they can bear on their wires a telephone message and report it 3,000 and more miles away. By means of this, says the patent record of February 1901, it will be an easy matter at no remote date to talk around the world. We shall have occasion to refer to them again when we come to see what prophecy says on this subject. Again, it says, the question of ocean telephony has been solved from a scientific standpoint, and there only remains the commercial question, which is a trifling matter to the company controlling the patent, and it is understood that it will only be a short time when cables of this kind will be constructed and laid, and then any part of the United States will be within conversational distance of any part of Europe. And should the same rate of progress, compared with the past, continue a few years longer, the figures we now chronicle will be relegated to the musty records of outlived years. Count Zeppelin's airship, which, to a certain degree and for particular purposes, seems to be, from the latest accounts, a marked success, opens another broad field in which American genius will exploit itself in the immediate future. See also. epilogue to this work. In 1876, there was published a history of the United States called The Centennial History. We give an extensive quotation from the work because it will be of interest to the reader, as it was issued only a short quarter of a century ago, and its statements bring to view so clearly the small beginnings of what are now the great features of this country. It says, "Here, on the verge of the centennial anniversary of the birth of our republic, let us take a brief review of the material and intellectual progress of our country during the first 100 years of its political independence. The extent of the conceded domain of the United States in 1776 was not more than 500,000 square miles. Now, when the word now appears in this relation, it means the year 1901, or statistics as near thereto as can be obtained. It is more than 3,300,000 square miles. According to latest statistics, with the territory acquired from the Spanish War, 3,758,884 square miles. Its population then was about 2,803,000. Now, 76,343,461. And including the inhabitants of Puerto Rico and the Philippines, the accessions from the Spanish War, 87 million. The Spanish-American War commenced with the declaration of war by Congress, April 21, 1898. The first shot was fired on the following day, Friday, April 22. The war ended on the suspension of hostilities, August 12, 1898, and the peace protocol between the United States and Spain was signed by the commissioners, 5 Spanish, 5 Americans, at Paris, December 10, 1898. Products of the soil. The products of the soil are the foundations of the material wealth of a nation. It has been eminently so with us, notwithstanding the science of agriculture and construction of good implements of labor were greatly neglected until the early part of the 19th century. 100 years ago, the agricultural interests of our country were mostly in the hands of uneducated men. Science was not applied to husbandry. A spirit of improvement was scarcely known. The son copied the ways of his father. He worked with no other implements and pursued no other methods of cultivation, and he who attempted a change was regarded as a visionary or an innovator. Very little associated effort for improvement in the business of farming was then seen. The first association for such a purpose was formed in the South and was known as the South Carolina Agricultural Society, organized in 1784. A similar society was formed in Pennsylvania the following year. Now there are state, county, and even town agricultural societies in almost every part of the Union. Agricultural implements were rude and simple. They consisted chiefly of the plow, harrow, spade, hoe, hand rake, scythe, sickle, and wooden fork. The plow had a clumsy wrought iron share with wooden mold board, which was sometimes plated with old tin or sheet iron. The rest of the structure was equally clumsy, and the implement required in its use twice the amount of strength of man and beast that the present plow does. Improvements in the construction of plows during the past 50 years saved to the country annually, in work and teams, at least $20 million. The first patent for a cast iron plow was issued in 1797. To the beginning of 1875, about 400 patents had been granted. 100 years ago, the seed was sown by hand, and the entire crop was harvested by hard manual labor. The grass was cut with a scythe, and cured and gathered with a fork and hand rake. The grain was cut with a sickle, thrashed with a flail or the treading of horses, and was cleared of the chaff by a large clamshell-shaped fan of wickerwork used in a gentle breeze. The drills, seed sowers, cultivators, reapers, thrashing machines, and fanning mills of our day were all unknown. They are the inventions of a time within the memory of living men. Abortive attempts were made toward the close of the 18th century to introduce a thrashing machine from England, but the flail held sway until 2 generations ago. Indian corn, tobacco, wheat, rye, oats, potatoes, and hay were the staple products of the farm 100 years ago. Timothy and orchard grass had just been introduced. At the present time, 1901, these products amount annually, on an average, in round numbers, to the following figures. Indian corn, 2,078,143,933 bushels. Wheat, 547,303,846 bushels. Rye, 33,961,741 bushels. Oats, 796,177,713 bushels. Potatoes, 228,783,232 bushels. And buckwheat, introduced within the century, 11,094,471 bushels. The hay crop averages about 56,655,756 tons. Tobacco, 741,980,576 pounds. Flaxseed, 17,217,000 pounds. To these agricultural products, there have been added, during the century, barley, cotton, and sugar. The barley crop averages about 73,381,563 bushels. Cotton, about 9,439,559 bales, which, with 487 pounds to the bale, the standard weight for 1900, give us 4,596,005,233 pounds. And of sugar, 557,657,417 pounds. Cotton culture. The expansion of the cotton culture has been marvelous. In 1784, 8 bales of cotton sent to England from Charleston, South Carolina, were seized by the custom house authorities in Liverpool, on the ground that so large a quantity could not have come from the United States. The progress of its culture was slow, until the invention of the cotton gin in 1793 by Eli Whitney, a machine which, by means of saw-teeth discs, was adapted to separate rapidly the fiber from the seed. It did the work of many persons. The cultivation of cotton rapidly increased. From 1792 to 1800, the amount of cotton raised had increased from 138,000 pounds to 18 million pounds, all of which was wanted in England, where improved machinery was manufacturing it into cloth. The value of the cotton crop in 1792 was $30,000. Now the reader can judge of its value when he thinks of the production of over 4 billions of pounds annually. Fruit culture. Fruit culture, 100 years ago, was very little thought of. Inferior varieties of apples, pears, peaches, plums, and cherries were cultivated for family use. It was not till the beginning of the 19th century that any large orchards were planted. The cultivation of grapes and berries was almost wholly unknown 75 years ago. The first horticultural society was formed in 1829. Before that time, fruit was not an item of commercial statistics in our country. But as late as 1876, the average annual value of fruit was estimated at $40 million, the grape crop alone exceeding in value $10 million. Livestock. Improvements in livestock have all been made within the last century. The native breeds were descended from stock sent over to the colonies and were generally inferior. In 1772, Washington wrote in his diary, "With 100 milch cows on my farm, I have to buy butter for my family." Now, there are about 44 million horned cattle in the United States, equal in average quality to those of any country in the world. The product of the dairy cows exceeds $500 million. Farm animals. 100 years ago, mules and asses were chiefly used for farming purposes and ordinary transportation. Carriage horses were imported from Europe. Now, our horses of every kind are equal to those of any other country. Statistics show that there are about 13,537,534 horses in the United States, or one to about every six persons. The aggregate value of horses is $603,969,442. Sheep husbandry. Sheep husbandry has greatly improved. The inferior breeds of the last century, raised only in sufficient quantity to supply the table and the domestic looms in the manufacture of yarns and coarse cloth, have been superseded by some of the finer varieties. Merino sheep were introduced early in the 19th century. The embargo before the War of 1812 and the establishment of manufactures here afterward stimulated sheep and wool raising, and these have been important items in our national wealth. There are now about 41,883,065 sheep in the United States. The total value of farm animals is $2,212,756,578. Swine. Improvements in the breed of swine have been very great during the last 50 years. They have become a large item in our commercial national statistics. At this time, there are about 28,172,000 head of swine in this country. Enormous quantities of pork, packed and in the form of bacon, are exported annually. These brief statistics of the principal products of agriculture show its development in this country and its importance. Daniel Webster said, "Agriculture feeds us. To a great extent, it clothes us. Without it, we should not have manufactures, we should not have commerce. They all stand together like pillars in the cluster, the largest in the center, and that largest, agriculture." Manufactures. The great manufacturing interests of our country are the product of the century just closed. The policy of the British government was to suppress manufacturing in the English American colonies, and cloth making was confined to the household. When non-importation agreements cut off supplies from Great Britain, the Irish flax wheel and the Dutch wool wheel were made active in families. All other kinds of manufacturing were of small account in this country until the concluding decade of the 18th century. In Great Britain, the inventions of Hargreaves, Arkwright, and Crompton had stimulated the cotton and woolen manufacturers, and the effects finally reached the United States. Massachusetts offered a grant of money to promote the establishment of a cotton mill, and one was built at Beverly in 1787, the first erected in the United States. It had not the improved English machinery. In 1789, Samuel Slater came from England with a full knowledge of that machinery, and in connection with Messrs. Almy and Brown of Providence, R.I., established a cotton factory there in 1790 with the improved implements. Then was really begun the manufacture of cotton in the United States. 20 years later, the number of cotton mills in our country was 168 with 90,000 spindles. The business has greatly expanded. In Massachusetts, the foremost state in the manufacture of cotton, there are now over 200 mills, employing, in prosperous times, 50,000 persons, and with a capital of more than $30 million. The city of Lowell was founded by the erection of a cotton mill there in 1822, and there, soon afterward, the printing of calico was first begun in the United States. With wool, as with cotton, the manufacture into cloth was confined to households for home use until near the close of the 18th century. The wool was carded between two cards held in the hands of the operator, and all the processes were slow and crude. In 1797, Asa Whittemore of Massachusetts invented a carding machine, and this led to the establishment of woolen manufactories outside of families. In his famous Report on Manufactures in 1791, Alexander Hamilton said that of woolen goods, hats only had reached maturity. The business had been carried on with success in colonial times. The wool was felted by hand, and furs were added by the same slow process. This manual labor continued until a little more than 36 years ago, when it was supplanted by machinery. Immense numbers of hats of every kind are now made in our country. At the time of Hamilton's report, there was only one woolen mill in the United States. This was at Hartford, Connecticut. In it were made cloths and cassimeres. Now, woolen factories may be found in almost every state in the Union, turning out annually the finest cloths, cassimeres, flannels, carpets, and every variety of goods made of wool. In this business, as in cotton, Massachusetts has taken the lead. The value of manufactured woolens in the United States at the close of the Civil War was estimated at about $60 million. The supply of wool in the United States has never been equal to the increasing demand. This group of cattle well represents the improvements that have been made in stock raising in the United States since the early years. It was seen long ago that a very important work might be accomplished in the improvement of the quality of the cattle and various animals raised. This work was taken hold of intelligently and patiently, and the result is now seen before us. A glance at the pictures will show what has been accomplished more plainly than words could do. Instead of the poor, undeveloped specimens of former years, we have now the different breeds brought up to a high standard of perfection, developed into well-proportioned figures with vigorous and healthy constitutions and famous fattening qualities, till American animals surpass those bred and raised in any other country. The iron industry. The smelting of iron ore and the manufacture of iron has become an immense business in our country. The development of ore deposits and of coal used in smelting are among the marvels of our history. English navigation laws discouraged iron manufacture in the colonies. Only blast furnaces for making pig iron were allowed. This product was nearly all sent to England in exchange for manufactured articles, and the whole amount of such exportation at the beginning of the old war for independence was less than 8,000 tons annually. The colonists were wholly dependent upon Great Britain for articles manufactured of iron and steel, excepting rude implements made by blacksmiths for domestic use. During the war, the Continental Congress was compelled to establish manufactures of iron and steel. These were chiefly in northern New Jersey, the Hudson Highlands, and western Connecticut, where excellent ore was found and forests in abundance for making charcoal. Great Britain produced in 1899 9,393,018 tons of iron. The production in the United States in the same time was 13,620,703 tons. The first use of anthracite coal for smelting iron was in the Continental Armory at Carlisle in Pennsylvania in 1775. But charcoal was universally used until 1840 for smelting ores. Now iron is manufactured in our country in every form, from a nail to a locomotive. A vast number of machines have been invented for carrying on these manufactures, and the products in cutlery, firearms, railway materials, and machinery of every kind employ vast numbers of men and a great amount of capital. Our locomotive builders are regarded as the best in the world, and no nation on the globe can compete with us in the construction of steamboats of every kind, from the ironclad war steamer to the harbor tug. Manufacture of copper, silver, and gold products. There has been great progress in these lines. At the close of the Revolution, no manufactures of the kind existed in our country. Now the manufacture of copperware yearly, of every kind of jewelry and watches, has become a large item in our commercial tables. Copper mining. On the subject of copper mining, the following statement by Walden Fawcett in the Scientific American of June 8, 1901, will be of interest, not only as a matter of information, but as showing how the United States is leading the world in this important industry also. He says, "No phase of the development of the natural resources of the United States has been characterized by more rapid or more really remarkable progress than the growth of the copper industry. For one thing, this commodity holds the unparalleled record of having shown, even in the face of financial panics and business depression, an increase of production during practically every year since the inauguration of operations. Until now, the annual output of the metal is worth approximately $100 million, or considerably more than all the gold produced in this country during an equal interval. Perhaps even more impressive is the fact that the United States has, within little more than half a century, risen to the position of mining more copper than all the rest of the world combined, and in so doing, has virtually control over the markets of the globe. Copper is produced in the United States, principally in Arizona, California, Colorado, Michigan, Montana, and Utah, although various other divisions of the Union, particularly the eastern and southern states, make contributions to the aggregate output. During the past two decades, however, the center of production has moved westward. In 1845, the year which marks the commencement of modern copper mining on this side of the Atlantic, the total production of the United States was estimated at 100 tons, of which Michigan yielded a dozen tons. From that time forward, the ascendancy of the Lake Superior Copper District over other sections became more and more pronounced. In 1856, Michigan miners took from the ground over 9/10 of all the copper secured in the country, and as late as 1880, the Michigan output constituted more than 4/5 of the total production. Then came the development of nature's great storehouse of copper in Montana. And although the record of growth was fully as meteoric as had been the career of the Lake Superior Territory, it was not till 1892 that Montana finally displaced Michigan as the greatest copper-producing state. The same relative positions have been maintained ever since. On a rough estimate, Montana furnishes about 40% and the Lake Superior mines about 25% of the American production of copper. Arizona, wherein is located the most recently discovered of the three great copper fields, ranks next to Michigan, her copper mining operations footing up about 1/5 of the grand total. It is interesting, if not significant, to note that Arizona showed the greatest gain in production recorded during the closing year of the century, whereas Montana showed but a slight increase, and the Lake Superior District barely held its own. The expansion of the scope of the copper mining industry has been attended by an improvement of methods and facilities fully as great as has been afforded in any other branch of mining operations, if not greater. To appreciate the extent of the betterment, it is only necessary to compare the economical and efficient mining systems and reduction plants in use today with the primitive methods of half a century ago, when much of the copper was taken from the rock by means of drills and gads. The recent introduction of black powder for blasting purposes was a long step ahead and opened the way for other innovations. Under the present plan, new shafts are sunk with incredible rapidity. Diamond drills are extensively employed in making explorations, and power drills are in almost universal use in mining operations proper. Instead of being dependent upon oxen and hoisting buckets by means of a windlass, as in the old days, the modern copper mine is equipped with hoisting engines of from 5,000 to 8,000 horsepower, which hoist 10-ton cars of rock from a depth of nearly a mile at a speed of 55 miles an hour. Originally, the copper mine operators introduced gravity stamp mills, but these proved totally inadequate, and latterly, steam mills have been provided of such power in some instances that an average of 350 tons of ore can be crushed daily at a single mill. The equipment of a large modern copper mine also includes powerful air compressors capable of supplying 50 air drills and fans 30 feet in diameter, with a capacity of 100,000 cubic feet of air a minute for underground ventilation. Some of the older copper mines in the United States rank among the deepest holes in the world. The Red Jacket shaft in the Lake Superior District, for instance, an opening about 12 feet by 25 feet in size, has been sunk vertically to a depth of nearly 5,000 feet and is claimed to be the largest and deepest shaft of its class in the world. This shaft has a vertical depth of nearly 1 mile, and branching out from the main shaft are innumerable cross-cut channels through which the copper ore is carried to the main artery of communication and hoisted to the surface in 10-ton cages, each of which makes half a dozen round trips in an hour, enabling the hoisting of more than 5,000 tons of ore from this one mine every working day in the year. Of the profits of copper mining, Mr. Fawcett says, if the copper taken from the ground in America during an average year is estimated to be worth $100 million, it is safe to credit $50 million as net profits. Europe, he says, consumes an enormous quantity of copper, and for a heavy proportion of it, she must depend upon the United States. In the United Verde mine at Jerome, Arizona, the shaft has as yet pierced the ore only about 600 feet, but the drill shows rich ore 1,400 feet farther. The Calumet and Hecla Company, Michigan, have the largest mining camp in the world. Some of the most highly skilled workmen receive nearly $10 a day. Quoting again from the Centennial History of the United States, the manufacture of paper. The manufacture of paper is a very large item in the business of our country. At the close of the Revolution, there were only 3 mills in the United States. At the beginning of the war, a demand sprang up, and Wilcox, in his mill near Philadelphia, made the first writing paper produced in this country. He manufactured the thick, coarse paper on which the Continental money was printed. So early as 1794, the business had so increased that there were, in Pennsylvania alone, 48 paper mills. There has been a steady increase in the business ever since. Within the last 25 years, previous to 1876, the increase has been enormous, and yet not sufficient to meet the demand. Improvements in printing presses have cheapened the production of books and newspapers, and the circulation of these has greatly increased. It is estimated that the amount of paper now manufactured annually in the United States for these, for paper hangings, and for wrapping paper is full 800 million pounds. The supply of raw material here has not been equal to the demand, and rags, to the value of about $2 million in a year, have been imported. The manufacture of ships, carriages, wagons, automobiles, clocks and watches, pins, leather, glass, Indian rubber, silk, wool, sewing machines, and a variety of other things wholly unknown or feebly carried on 100 years ago, now flourish and form very important items in our domestic commerce. The sewing machine is an American invention, and the first really practical one was first offered to the public by Elias Howe, Jr. about 1846. A patent had been obtained for one 5 years before. Great improvements have been made, and now a very extensive business in the manufacture and sale of sewing machines is carried on by different companies, employing a large amount of capital and costly machinery and a great number of persons. Mining industry. The mining interests of the United States have become an eminent part of the national wealth. The extraction of lead, iron, copper, the precious metals and coal from the bosom of the earth is a business that has almost wholly grown up within the last 100 years. In 1754, a lead mine was worked in southwestern Virginia, and in 1778, Dubuque, a French miner, worked lead ore deposits on the western bank of the Upper Mississippi. The Jesuit missionaries discovered copper in the Lake Superior region more than 200 years ago. That metal is produced in smaller quantities in other states. Gold production. A lust for gold and the knowledge of its existence in America was the chief incentive to emigration to these shores. But within the domain of our republic, very little of it was found until that domain was extended far toward the Pacific Ocean. It was unsuspected until long after the Revolution. Finally, gold was discovered among the mountains of Virginia, North and South Carolina, and in Georgia. North Carolina was the first state in the Union to send gold to the mint in Philadelphia. Its first small contribution was in 1804. From that time until 1823, the average amount produced from North Carolina mines did not exceed $2,500 annually. Virginia's first contribution was in 1829. When that of North Carolina, for that year, was $128,000. Georgia sent its first contribution in 1830. It amounted to $212,000. The product so increased that branch mints were established in North Carolina and Georgia in 1837 and 1838, and another in New Orleans. In 1848, Gold was discovered on the American Fork of the Sacramento River in California, and soon afterward, elsewhere in that region. A gold fever seized the people of the United States, and thousands rushed to California in search of the precious metal. Within a year from the discovery, nearly 50,000 people were there. Less than 5 years afterward, California, in 1 year, sent to the United States Mint full $40 million in gold. Its entire gold product to this time is estimated at more than $800 million. Over all the far western states and territories, the precious metals, gold and silver, seem to be scattered in profusion, and the amount of mineral wealth yet to be discovered there seems to be incalculable. Our coal fields seem to be inexhaustible, and out of the bosom of the earth, in portions of our country, flow millions of barrels annually of petroleum or rock oil, affording the cheapest illuminating material in the world. This is another source of wealth to the country, equal to the output of gold. Mineral coal was first discovered and used in Pennsylvania at the period of the Revolution. A boatload was sent down the Susquehanna from Wilkes-Barre for the use of the Continental Works at Carlisle. But it was not much used before the War of 1812, and the regular business of mining this fuel did not become a part of the commerce of the country before the year 1820, when 365 tons were sent to Philadelphia. At the present time, the amount of coal sent to market from the American mines, of all kinds, is equal to full 15 million tons annually. Commerce. The commerce of the United States has had a wonderful growth. Its most active development was seen in New England. British legislation imposed heavy burdens upon it in colonial times, and, like manufactures, it was greatly depressed. The New Englanders built many vessels for their own use, but more for others, and just before the breaking out of the Revolution, there was quite a brisk trade carried on between the English-American colonies and the West Indies, as well as with the mother country. The colonists exported tobacco, lumber, shingles, staves, masts, turpentine, hemp, flax, pot and pearl ashes, salted fish in great quantities, some corn, livestock, pig iron, and skins and furs procured by traffic with the Indians. Whale and cod fishing was an important branch of commerce. In the former, there were 160 vessels employed at the beginning of 1775, and sperm candles and whale oil were exported to Great Britain. In exchange for New England products, a large amount of molasses was brought from the West Indies and made into rum to sell to the Indians and fishermen and to exchange for slaves on the coast of Africa. At the close of the war, the British government refused to enter into commercial relations with the United States government, believing that the weak League of States would soon be dissolved. But when a vigorous national government was formed in 1789, Great Britain, for the first, sent a resident minister to our government and entered into a commercial arrangement with us. Meanwhile, a brisk trade had sprung up between the colonies and Great Britain, as well as with other countries. From 1784 to 1790, the exports from the United States to Great Britain amounted to $33 million, and the imports from Great Britain to $87 million. At the same time, several new and important branches of industry had appeared and flourished with great rapidity. From that time, the expansion of American commerce was marvelous, in spite of the checks it received from British jealousy, wars, piracies in the Mediterranean Sea and elsewhere, and the effects of embargoes. The tonnage of American ships, which in 1789 was 201,562, was in 1870 more than 7 million. At the present time, England is purchasing from the United States 8 times as much as she sells to this country. There is no surer index to the growing financial strength of a nation than the sum of its exports and imports. Exports from the United States in 1899 amounted to $1,370,363,571. Imports for the same year, $849,941,840. Excess of exports over imports, $520,421,731. Exports from this country to Europe for 1900 crossed for the first time the billion-dollar line. To other parts of the world, the exports for 1900 were 27% in excess over exports for 1899. The domestic commerce of the United States is immense. A vast seacoast line, great lakes, large rivers, and many canals afford scope for interstate commerce and commerce with adjoining countries not equaled by those of any other nation. The canal and railway systems in the United States are the product chiefly of the century just closed. So also is navigation by steam, on which river commerce chiefly relies for transportation. This was begun in the year 1807. The first canals made in this country were two short ones for a water passage around the South Hadley and Montague Falls in Massachusetts. These were constructed in 1792. At about the same time, the inland lock navigation companies in the state of New York began their work. The Middlesex Canal, connecting Lowell with Boston Harbor, was completed in 1808, and the Great Erie Canal, 363 miles in length, was finished in 1825 at a cost of almost $8 million, this to be enlarged by plans already in progress. The aggregate length of canals built in the United States is 3,200 miles. Railways. The first railway built in the United States was 13 miles in length. It was completed in 1827. Horsepower was used. The first use of a locomotive in this country was in 1829, when one was put upon a railway that connected the coal mines of the Delaware and Hudson Canal Company with Honesdale. The first passenger railway was opened in 1830, as stated on pages 37-38. Now, railways form a thick network all over the United States east of the Mississippi and are rapidly spreading over the states and territories beyond to the Pacific. The telegraph. To these facilities for commercial operations must be added the electromagnetic telegraph, an American invention, as a method of transmitting intelligence and giving warning signals to the shipping and agricultural interests concerning the actual and probable state of the weather each day. The first line, 40 miles in length, was constructed between Baltimore and Washington in 1844. Now the lines are extended to every part of our Union and all over the civilized world, traversing oceans and rivers and bringing Persia and New York within 1 hour's space of intercommunication. Banking. Banking institutions and insurance companies are intimately connected with commerce. The first bank in the United States was established in 1781 as a financial aid to the government. It was called the Bank of North America. The Bank of New York and the Bank of Massachusetts were established soon afterward. On the recommendation of Hamilton in 1791, a national bank was established at Philadelphia with a capital of $10 million, of which sum the government subscribed $2 million. Various banking systems under state charters have since been tried. During the Civil War, a system of national banking was established, by which there is a uniform paper currency throughout the Union. The number of national banks at the close of 1863 was 66. The number at the close of 1874 was not far from 1,700, involving capital to the amount of almost $500 million. Insurance. Fire, marine, and life insurance companies have flourished greatly in the United States. The first incorporated company was established in 1792 in Philadelphia and known as the Fire Insurance Company of North America. Another was established in Providence, Rhode Island, in 1799, and another in New York in 1806. The first life insurance company was chartered in Massachusetts in 1825. And the New York Life Insurance and Trust Company was established in 1829. All others are of recent organization. As a rule, the business of insurance of every kind is profitable to the insurer and the insured. The amount of capital engaged in it is enormous. The fire risks alone, at the close of 1874, amounted to about $200 million. January 1, 1900, they were $11,694,469,849. Immigration. Our growth in population has been steadily increased by immigration from Europe. It began very moderately after the Revolution. From 1784 to 1794, the average number of immigrants a year was 4,000. During the last 10 years, the number of persons who have immigrated to the United States from Europe is estimated at over 2 million, who brought with them, in the aggregate, $200 million in money. This capital and the productive labor of the immigrants have added much to the wealth of our country. This immigration and wealth is less than during the 10 years preceding the Civil War, during which time there came to this country from Europe 2,814,554 persons, bringing with them an average of at least $100, or an aggregate of over $281 million. The whole number of immigrants from 1789 to 1901 was 20,015,155. Arts and Sciences. The arts, sciences, and invention have made great progress in our country during the last 100 years. These, at the close of the Revolution, were of little account in estimating the advance of the race. The practitioners of the arts of design at that period were chiefly Europeans. Of native artists, C.W. Peel and J.S. Copley stood at the head of painters. There were no sculptors and no engravers of any eminence. Architects, in the proper sense, there were none. After the Revolution, a few good painters appeared, and these have gradually increased in numbers and excellence, without much encouragement, except in portraiture, until within the last 25 years. We have now good sculptors, architects, engravers, and lithographers, and in all of these departments, as well as in photography and photo engraving, very great progress has been made within the last 30 or 40 years. Alexander Anderson was the first man who engraved on wood in the United States. He died in 1870 at the age of 95 years. In banknote engraving, we have attained to greater excellence than any other people. It is considered the most perfect branch of the art in design and execution. Associations have been formed for improvements in the arts of design. The first was organized in Philadelphia in 1791 by C.W. Peel in connection with Seracchi, the Italian sculptor. It failed. In 1802, the American Academy of Fine Arts was organized in the city of New York, and in 1807, the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts, yet in existence, was established in Philadelphia. In 1826, the American Academy of Fine Arts was superseded by the National Academy of Design in the city of New York. Education. In education and literature, our progress has kept pace with other things. In the very beginning of settlements, the common school was made the special care of the state in New England. Not so much attention was given to this matter elsewhere in the colonies. The need of higher institutions of learning was early felt, and 18 years after the landing of the Pilgrims from the Mayflower, Harvard College was founded. When the War for Independence began, there were 9 colleges in the colonies, namely Harvard at Cambridge, Massachusetts, Williams and Mary at Williamsburg, Virginia, Yale at New Haven, Connecticut, College of New Jersey at Princeton, University of Pennsylvania at Philadelphia, King's, now Columbia, in the city of New York, Brown University at Providence, RI, Dartmouth at Hanover, New Hampshire, and Rutgers at New Brunswick, New Jersey. There were, at the beginning of 1901, 421 colleges in the United States. At the period of the Revolution, teaching in the common schools was very meager and remained so for full 30 years. Only reading, spelling, and arithmetic were regularly taught. The Psalter, the New Testament, and the Bible constituted the reading books. No history was read, no geography or grammar was taught, and until the putting forth of Webster's spelling book in 1783, pronunciation was left to the judgment of teachers. That book produced a revolution. As the nation advanced in wealth and intelligence, the necessity for correct popular education became more and more manifest, and associated efforts were made for the improvement of the schools by providing for the training of teachers under the respective phrases of teachers' associations, educational periodicals, normal schools, and teachers' institutes. The first of these societies in this country was the Middlesex County Association for the Improvement of Common Schools, established at Middletown, Connecticut in 1799. But little of importance was done in that direction until within the last 45 years. Now, provision is made in all sections of the Union, not only for the support of common schools, but for training schools for teachers. Since the Civil War, great efforts have been made to establish common school systems in the late slave labor states that should include among the beneficiaries the colored population. Much has been done in that regard. Very great improvements have been made in the organization and discipline of the public schools in cities within the last 30 years. Free schools are rapidly spreading their beneficent influence over the whole Union, and in some states, laws have been made that compel all children of a certain age to go to school. Institutions for the special culture of young women in all that pertains to college education have been established within a few years. The pioneer in this work is Vassar College at Poughkeepsie, New York, which was first opened in the year 1865. Besides the ordinary means for education, others have been established for special purposes. There are law, scientific, medical, theological, military, commercial, and agricultural schools, and seminaries for the deaf, dumb, and blind. In many states, school district libraries have been established. There are continually enlarging means provided for the education of the whole people. Edmund Burke said, "Education is the cheap defense of nations." Among the educational institutions that have been established to furnish educational advantages to the middle classes, to laboring men, and to those who have lost or been deprived of youthful privileges, and to enable them to recover educational privileges while pursuing their ordinary vocations, may be mentioned a model and progressive one in a neighboring state, which employs 266 professors and has upon its roll the names of 130,000 students. Literature. Our literature is as varied as the tastes of the people. No subject escapes the attention of our native scholars and authors. At the period of the Revolution, books were few in variety and number. The larger portion of them were devoted to theological subjects. Booksellers were few and were found only in the larger cities. Various subjects were discussed in pamphlets, not generally in newspapers as now. The editions of books were small, and as stereotyping was unknown, they became rare in a few years because there was only a costly way of reproduction. The publishing work. In the year 1801, a new impetus was given to the book trade by the formation of the American Company of Booksellers, a kind of union. 20 years later, competition broke up the association. Before the War of 1812, the book trade in the United States was small. Only school books had very large sales. Webster's spelling book was an example of the increasing demand for such helps to education. During the 20 years he was engaged on his dictionary, the income from his spelling book supported him and his family. It was published in 1783, and its sales have continually increased to the present time, when they amount to over 1 million copies a year. Other school books of every kind now have an immense annual circulation. The general book trade in this country is now immense in the number of volumes issued and the capital and labor employed. Readers are rapidly increasing. An ardent thirst for knowledge or entertainment to be found in books, magazines, and newspapers makes a very large demand for these vehicles, while, at the same time, they produce widespread intelligence. The magazine literature, now generally healthful, is a powerful coadjutor of books in this popular culture. And the newspaper, not always so healthful, supplies the daily and weekly demand for ephemerals in literature and general knowledge. To meet that demand required great improvements in printing machinery, and these have been supplied. The printing press at the time of the revolution is shown in that used by Franklin, in which the pressure force was obtained by means of a screw. The ink was applied by huge balls, and an expert workman could furnish about 50 impressions an hour. This was improved by Earl Stanhope in 1815 by substituting for the screw a jointed lever. Then came inking machines, and one man could work off 250 copies an hour. Years passed on, and the cylinder press was invented. And in 1847, it was perfected by Richard M. Hoe of New York. This has been further improved, and a printing press is now used which will strike off 60,000 newspapers, printed on both sides, trimmed, folded, and pasted every hour. The newspapers printed in the United States at the beginning of the Revolution were few in number, small in size, and very meager in information of any kind. They were issued weekly, semi-weekly, and tri-weekly. The first daily newspaper issued in this country was the American Daily Advertiser, established in Philadelphia in 1784. In 1775, there were 37 newspapers and periodicals in the United States, with an aggregate issue that year of 1,200,000 copies. There are now about 40 newspapers in the United States, which have existed over 50 years. In 1901, there are 21,789 newspapers in all, 2,039 of them dailies. In the providing of means for moral and religious culture and benevolent enterprises, there has been great progress in this country during the century just closed. The various religious denominations have increased in membership fully in proportion to the increase of population. Asylums of every kind for the unfortunate and friendless have been multiplied in an equal ratio, and provision is made for all. Postal Service. One of the most conspicuous examples of the growth of our republic is presented by the Postal Service. Dr. Franklin had been colonial postmaster general, and he was appointed to the same office for 1 year by the Continental Congress in the summer of 1775. He held the position a little more than a year, and at the end of his official term, there were about 50 post offices in the United States. All the accounts of the General Post Office Department during that period were contained in a small book consisting of about two quires of foolscap paper, which is preserved in the department at Washington City. Through all the gloomy years of the weak Confederacy, the business of the department was comparatively light, and when the national government began its career in 1789, there were only about 75 post offices, with an aggregate length of post roads of about 1,900 miles. The annual income was $28,000, and the annual expenditures were $32,000. The mails were carried by postmen on horseback and sometimes on foot. The Post Office Department of the United States is shown by facts and figures to be the greatest business corporation on the earth. The number of its offices is 76,688. The extent of its post routes in miles is 500,982. Its revenue in 1900 was $102,354,579. Its expenditures during the same period, $107,740,268. The miles traveled on its routes would make 2.5 round trips to the sun. The annual weight of mail carried is 664,286,868 pounds. To haul it would require 500 locomotives and 33,214 freight cars, forming a train 300 miles long. The 6,576,310,000 pieces of mail matter annually transported, if placed together, would make a band 7 feet wide around the world. Rural mail delivery, now being inaugurated in most parts of the country, will soon bring mail matter to the door of every person addressed in the United States. The lumber industry. One of the most important industries of the world is the lumber business. The traffic in timber for building houses, ships, etc., and manufacturing purposes. The principal nations engaged in this business outside of the United States are Norway, Russia, Germany, British North America, and to some extent, France. In our own country, immense lumber districts are found in Maine, New York, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Illinois, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Indiana, some portions of the southern states, California, and Oregon. The more important centers of the trade are Bangor, Maine, Boston, Chicago, the lake ports generally, Albany, New York, Savannah and Brunswick, Georgia, and Pensacola, Florida. There were in 1870, 26,945 lumber manufactories, employing 163,637 men, using 161,500,273 invested capital, paying $46,201,328 in wages, and producing 252,339,029 worth of lumber. Grave fears are excited by the meteorological effects which are likely to follow this removal of the forests. At the present rate of cutting, the forest land of the United States cannot long meet the enormous demand made upon it. By far, the greater part of the white pine has been cut, and vast inroads have been made into the supply of other valuable timbers. In many sections of the country, more timber falls by fire than by the axe. The average annual loss from fire is not less than $20 million. For the preservation of the forests, the state of New York first instituted a forest commission in 1885. The states of Kansas, Michigan, Minnesota, Maine, New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin also have special commissions under their forestry laws. The Pennsylvania Legislature of 1897 provided for the purchase of three forest reserves of not less than 40,000 acres each, and the Wisconsin Assembly appointed a commission to formulate and recommend forest legislation. Michigan also, in 1899, appointed a commission to study the forest question and select land for a state forest reserve. World Almanac, 1901. Rate of growth. The rate of growth maintained in this country since the compilation of the figures a few years ago may be best shown by comparing some of them with the census of 1900. Thus, the people of the United States at the last named date possessed, in round numbers, 43,902,400 horned cattle and 28,172,000 swine. This is a larger number of cattle than any other nation can show, India having but 30 million and Russia 24,609,260. We have 13,537,534 horses, being surpassed in this respect only by Russia, which has 19,683,340. We come fourth in the list of sheep-raising nations, having only 43,883,065. But in the food-producing animals, cattle and hogs, our country leads the world. According to returns for the year 1901, our corn crop amounted to 2,078,143,933 bushels. Wheat, 547,303,845 bushels. Hay, 50,055,750 tons. Coal, 252,115,387 tons. Petroleum, 967,252,341 gallons. Pig iron, 13,838,634 tons. Manufactured steel rails, 10,706,800 tons. The Centennial History again says, "We may safely claim for our people and country a progress in all that constitutes a vigorous and prosperous nation during the century just past, equal, if not superior, to that of any other on the globe." and to the inventive genius and skill of the Americans may be fairly awarded a large share of the honor acquired by the construction of machinery, which has so largely taken the place of manual labor. In that progress, the American citizen beholds a tangible prophecy of a brilliant future for his country. In the nautical fields, no pains or expense has been spared to utilize the most recent inventions and improvements to guard against danger and loss, and by lighthouses, breakwaters, etc., to make everything safe as possible for sailors and navigators. Among the latest equipments for the United States Lighthouse Service is a 90 million candle power electric light, the reflection from which, when placed on a sufficient elevation, can be seen 147 nautical miles. And nature herself, by the physical features she has stamped upon our country, has seemed to lay it out as a field for national developments on the most magnificent scale. Here we have the largest lakes, the longest rivers, the mightiest cataracts, the deepest caves, the broadest and most fertile prairies, and the richest mines of gold, iron, and coal, copper, silver, and other minerals to be found upon the globe.
When America was discovered, there were but 60 millions of gold in Europe. California and the territories around her have produced 1,000 millions of dollars in gold in 20 years. $61 million was the largest annual gold yield ever made in Australia. California has several times produced 90 millions of gold in a year. Townsend, page 381. The area of workable coal beds in all the world outside the United States is estimated at 26,000 square miles. That of the United States, not including Alaska, is estimated at over 200,000 square miles, or 8 times as large as the available coal area of all the rest of the globe. American Yearbook, page 605. The iron product and manufacture of the United States has increased enormously within the last few years, and the vast beds of iron convenient to coal in various parts of the Union are destined to make America the chief source of supply for the world. Three mountains of solid iron in Missouri, known as Iron Mountain, Pilot Knob, and Shepherd's Mountain, are among the most remarkable natural curiosities on our continent. Ida, page 654. And the people have taken hold to lay out their work on the grand scale that nature has indicated. Excepting only the Houses of Parliament in London, our national capital at Washington is the most spacious and imposing national edifice in the world. The United States government is planning to build the largest, most powerful, and fastest battleship that has ever been constructed. Its displacement will be one of 16,000 tons, or 1,000 tons more than the displacement of the most recent additions to the British Navy, and of the Georgia and Virginia battleships recently ordered for our own Navy. These vessels, once completed, the United States Navy will rank 5th among the navies of the world. By the unparalleled feat of a subterranean tunnel 2 miles, later increased to 4 miles, out under the bottom of the lake, Chicago obtains her water, and the works have been so enlarged by additional tunnels and pumping stations that a population of 3,500,000 can be supplied with 150 gallons of water per day, and there will still be ample reserve machinery. Chicago is the most extensive grain and lumber market in the world, and Philadelphia and New York contain the largest and best furnished printing establishments now in existence. The submarine cable, running like a thread of light through the depths of the broad Atlantic from the United States to England, a conception of American genius, is the first great achievement in the telegraphic line. And the Pacific Railway, that iron highway from the Atlantic to the Pacific, led the way for similar monuments of engineering skill in modern times. Following the first Atlantic cable, soon came a second, almost as a matter of course. And following the Central Pacific Railroad, a southern line has been opened, and a northern line has more recently been completed. Canada has also opened a Pacific Railroad line. This makes 4 transcontinental iron highways across the continent from the Atlantic seaboard to the Pacific.
and what results are expected to flow from such mighty enterprises. Referring to the Pacific Railway, the Scientific American says, "To exaggerate the importance of this transcontinental highway is almost impossible. To a certain extent, it will change the relative positions of this country, Europe, and Asia. With the completion of the Pacific Railroad, instead of receiving our goods from India, China, Japan, and the Isles of the Sea by way of London and Liverpool, we shall bring them direct by way of the Sandwich Islands and the railroad, and become the carriers to a great extent for Europe. But this is but a portion of the advantage of this work. Our western mountains are almost literally mountains of gold and silver. In them, the Arabian fable of Aladdin is realized. Let the road be completed, and the comforts as well as the necessaries furnished by Asia, the manufactures of Europe, and the productions of the States can be brought by the iron horse almost to the miner's door, and in the production and possession of the precious metals, the blood of commerce, we shall be the richest nation on the globe. But the substantial wealth created by the improvement of the soil and the development of the resources of the country is a still more important element in the result of this vast work. Thus, with the idea of becoming the carriers of the world, the highway of nations, and the richest power on the globe, the American heart swells with pride and mounts up with aspirations to which there is no limit. The extent to which we have come up is further shown by the influence which we are exerting on other nations. Speaking of America, Mr. Townsend, in the work above cited, page 462, says,
"Out of her discovery grew the European Reformation in religion. Out of our Revolutionary War grew the revolutionary period of Europe. And out of our rapid development among great states and happy people has come an immigration more wonderful than that which invaded Europe from Asia in the latter centuries of the Roman Empire. When we raised our flag on the Atlantic, Europe sent her contributions. It appeared on the Pacific, and all Orientalism felt the signal. They are coming in two endless fleets, and the highway is swung between the oceans for them to tread upon. We have lightened Ireland of half her weight, and Germany is coming by the village load every day. England herself is sending the best of her working men, and in such numbers as to dismay her Jack Bunsbys. What is to be the limit of this mighty immigration?" J.P. Thompson, United States as a Nation, page 180, says, "History gives examples of the migration of tribes and peoples for the occupation of new territories by settlement or conquest. But there is no precedent for a nation's receiving into its bosom millions of foreigners as equal sharers in its political rights and powers. With a magnanimity almost reckless, the United States has done this and has survived. Immigration first assumed proportions worthy of note in the decade from 1830 to 1840, when it reached the figure of 599,000. In the decade from 1840 to 1850, it increased to 1,713,000, and the report of the Bureau of Statistics for 1874 gives for the 10 calendar years from January 1, 1864 to December 31, 1873 inclusive, a net immigration of 3,287,994. To his statements, we add the more recent figures, which give the aggregate number of immigrants into the United States from 1789 down to the beginning of the year 1901 as 20,015,155. Compare these figures with the fact that the purchase of Louisiana, over 1 million square miles, brought with it scarcely 20,000 white inhabitants, and nearly 1 million square miles acquired through Texas and the Mexican cessions brought only some 50,000. And it will be seen how much more formidable has been the problem of immigration than that of territory. The American Traveler, published in Boston, Massachusetts, in its issue of February 24, 1883, says,
"The growth of immigration is one of the most striking facts of the period. In 1881, the total arrivals were 720,000, and in 1882, they rose to 735,000. These figures are impressive. They foreshadow an addition to our population by immigration alone, if this rate is maintained, of 7 million of persons in the next 10 years. This would be more than twice the entire population of the country at the beginning of our independence. It is estimated that last year's immigrants brought with them a cash capital of $62,470,000. And if each one is worth, as a producing machine, as is claimed from careful estimates, $1 million, Europe has added to our capital stock the past 2 years the handsome sum of $1,455,000,000. Speaking of our influence and standing in the Pacific, Mr. Townsend, fully appreciating the situation, page 608, says, "In the Pacific Ocean, these four powers, England, France, Holland, and Russia, are squarely met by the United States, which has paramount influence in Japan, the favor of China, the friendly countenance of Russia, and good feeling with all the great English colonies planted there. The United States is the only power on the Pacific which has not been guilty of intrigue, of double dealing, of envy, and of bitterness, and it has taken the front rank in influence without awakening the dislike of any of its competitors, possibly excepting those English who are never magnanimous." With one more extract, we close the testimony on this point. In the New York Independent of July 7, 1870, Honorable Schuyler Colfax, then Vice President of the United States, glancing briefly at the past history of this country, said,
"Wonderful indeed has been that history. Springing into life from under the heel of tyranny, its progress has been onward with the firm step of a conqueror. From the rugged clime of New England, from the banks of the Chesapeake, from the savannas of Carolina and Georgia, the descendants of the Puritans, the Cavalier, and the Huguenot swept over the towering Alleghenies. But a century ago, the barrier between civilization on the one side and almost unbroken barbarism on the other, and the banners of the Republic waved from Flagstaff and Highland through the broad valleys of the Ohio, the Mississippi, and the Missouri. Nor stopped its progress there. Thence onward poured the tide of American civilization and progress over the vast regions of the Western Plains, and from the snowy crests of the Sierras you look down on American states fronting the calm Pacific, an empire of themselves in resources and wealth, but loyal in our darkest hours to the nation whose authority they acknowledge and in whose glory they proudly share. From a territorial area of less than 900,000 square miles, it has expanded into over 3.5 million, 15 times larger than that of Great Britain and France combined, with a shoreline, including Alaska, equal to the entire circumference of the earth, and with a domain within these lines far wider than that of the Romans in their proudest days of conquest and renown. With a river, lake, and coastwise commerce estimated at over $2,000,000,000 per year, with railway traffic of from 4 to 6 million per year, and the annual domestic exchanges of the country running up to nearly $10,000,000,000 per year, with over $2,000,000,000 invested in manufacturing, mechanical, and mining industry, with over 500 millions of acres of land in actual occupancy valued, with their appurtenances, at over $7,000,000,000 and producing annually crops valued at over $3,000,000,000, with a realm which, if the density of Belgium's population were possible, would be vast enough to include all the present inhabitants of the world, and with equal rights guaranteed to even the poorest and humblest of over 40 millions of people, we can, with a manly pride akin to that which distinguished the palmiest days of Rome, claim, as the noblest title of the world, I am an American citizen."
And how long a time has it taken for this wonderful transformation? In the language of Edward Everett, "They are but lately dead who saw the firstborn of the Pilgrims." And Mr. Townsend, page 21, says, "The memory of one man can swing from that time of primitive government to this, when 38 millions of people," he could now say 76 and one quarter millions, "living on two oceans and in two zones,
are represented in Washington, and their consuls and ambassadors are in every port and metropolis of the globe.